Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Affney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're going to talk about foreign and domestic enemies with a man who has spent his life fighting both. His name is Charles Sam Faddis. I'm proud to say he is one of our regulars here at Securing America. You see him at War Room and a number of other outlets as well, notably AND Magazine at Substack, a vital resource. And we're always delighted to have a chance to visit with him about whatever's on his mind, which is generally what's on our mind, or should be at the very least. Sam, it's good to have you back in the house virtually. Welcome.
Always great to be here, Frank. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, we've had some really momentous developments in the past couple of days. You and I have talked off and on for months now about the elections. I want to come to those in a moment. But before we do, sort of a breaking news item as a result of the elections and the House of Representatives now being in Republican hands, albeit narrowly. Announcements made yesterday by two senior Republican legislators expected to become chairman of two of the key committees, Oversight and Judiciary, that there are going to be some very substantial investigations conducted, not just into, the vast array of people who are deeply in need of investigation in this administration, not just Hunter Biden and his conduct, but the President of the United States himself, Joe Biden. Talk a little bit about what seems to be now in prospect and its implications.
Well, we are, if we roll the tape back a little bit, obviously we will recall, our viewers of this program will certainly recall, that the Hunter Biden laptop comes out right before the last election, the 2020 election, and then the usual suspects bury the entire story. And then they've done their best to just prevent anybody from looking into all the implications of that ever since. Hopefully what we're looking at now is that we're going to finally begin to lay out for the American people what those of us who've seen the laptop have known for a long time, which is this is a massive, massive issue. This is not just inconvenient or a scandal around the margins. This is the kind of thing that potentially can topple a president, should topple a president, should have stopped the guy from ever being elected in the first place. It, of course, is a massive corruption scheme, been ongoing for a long time, but also, as you and I have talked about many times, has huge national security implications, because this is not just corruption and people getting rich and criminal actions as if like that's minor. But this has implications for who is in the White House, what his policies are, the whole direction of this administration, particularly when it comes to the amount of money that came from the Chinese Communist Party and folks directly connected to Chinese intelligence. So hopefully we're going to go to that, and potentially we're talking about bringing down a president.
I can't imagine, Sam, that he will withstand this scrutiny in his enfeebled state, right, or that, frankly, he'll even submit himself to it. My guess is that what happens is an early resignation, mm-hmm. Some sort of negotiations for a full pardon from his successor, mm-hmm. and then the game is on with respect to that successor and right. Who would be presumably her vice president. One of the things that, Sam, really strikes me about this, when James Comer, the prospective chair of the Oversight Committee, zeroed in, as you say, on Joe Biden's role in what I can only describe as aiding and abetting the Chinese Communist Party. Mm-hmm. Specifically, he talked about the penetration of our energy sector by the Chinese, which he didn't mention, maybe doesn't know, but I hope we can bring it to his attention, that they're already inside our energy sector in a big way. There are some 300 high-voltage transformers manufactured in China, that we know at least one of them had built-in back doors that would enable it to be remotely destroyed. That's a problem. Even if Joe didn't succeed in getting them into the natural gas business and drilling and all the rest of it. So this is an immense danger. And you're absolutely right. It has huge national security implications. But so I would argue, do the seeming compromises of Kamala Harris and Governor Newsom and the Obamas, including Michelle Obama, to similar kinds of, adversaries, and I think specifically in a number of those cases, at least, the Chinese communists as well. So shouldn't this be a standard going forward? If it's enough to actually cause this president to have to leave office, shouldn't it disqualify anybody else who's coming to it or hopes to?
Well, without question, it should. Now we'll get in, now we get into the politics of the matter. I mean, and how Biden leaves office and how long he hangs on and to what extent he now has forgotten that he's just a puppet and his job is to exit stage right when told to do so, and to what extent he now wants to say, no, I'm going to hang on and this kind of thing. From a smart, completely Machiavellian political standpoint, he will exit stage right under some sort of pretext of health early on in the investigation before it really is digging into the CCP angle and try to seal this off. But absolutely, it should have. I mean, as we've talked about all the time, the CCP has not just bought and paid for Joe. They have bought and paid for a whole host of individuals in our government and in our so-called elite. And we have a massive problem that goes way beyond Joe Biden that we need to get to the bottom of, and we need to stop this, or we're going to lose what is already, in effect, an undeclared war with China.
Yes, and may well eventuate here shortly into a full-on one. And actually, I technically, our friend Gordon Chang points out, the Chinese have actually declared it against us in the pages of the People's Daily in May 2019. Yep. But Sam, just on this point, it does seem to me that when you're talking about this kind of compromise, and you're absolutely right, we had Peter Schweitzer on the other day, you and Trevor Loudon have done fabulous work at accountabilityinitiative.org documenting the numbers of people, cabinet officers and sub-cabinet, who've been compromised by the Chinese Communist Party. This is the kind of thing that demands investigation, and whether Joe Biden punches out early or whether he, gets drawn and quartered, figuratively, by Congress, will, as you say, remain to be seen. But the elevation of and close examination of the Chinese Communist Party's influence operations and their penetration and subversion of our so-called elites has to be done. And it has to preclude others from coming to power who have similar problems. Sam, I want to pivot, and we've got to have to take a short break here in a moment, but just to introduce the topic to the work that you personally were doing and countless others across this country to try to assure that we had free and fair elections. The outcome is, I guess on the upside that the House of Representatives has changed hands, depending on who that leader in the House is, it will be a very big deal or a modest deal, but it's a change, and that's welcome. But it should have been, it seems to me, and could have been so much more. And I want to get into with you why it wasn't, as you see it, from the front lines of the election integrity effort in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. We'll be right back with more with Sam Faddis, the author of Beyond Repair, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The clock surely is now running on Joe Biden's resignation. If promises made yesterday by senior Republican congressmen come to fruition in less than 2 months, he will personally be subject to one or more investigations that could lead to criminal indictments.
The most serious line of inquiry would concern evidence that the big guy has effectively aided and abetted America's mortal enemy, the Chinese Communist Party. If that's confirmed, he must be prosecuted for treason, the highest of impeachable crimes and misdemeanors. In his enfeebled state, it strains credulity that Joe Biden will submit to such an investigation, let alone indictment. In exchange for his prompt resignation, he may seek, or at least receive, a full pardon. Either way, congressional investigators must ensure that henceforth the White House is not occupied by a president compromised by the Chinese Communist Party. This is Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We're continuing a conversation with one of our favorite guests. His name is Charles Sam Faddis, a longtime undercover operative of the Central Intelligence Agency. He has seen the enemy at close quarters, foreign and domestic, and I want to thank him again for his service to our country, both in the uniform of the United States Army, for that matter, as well as out of uniform, in government service, and since he left it. It's extraordinary what he does, and we're deeply grateful for his time week after week. Sam, we were talking a bit about the elections, and I wanted just to give you an opportunity to do a, well, they call it a post-mortem on what went wrong, what was really illegal as a practical matter, and what was just unfortunate and untoward, and what lessons we need to learn going forward.
Well, you know, to try to summarize this, the Republican Party is playing checkers and the Democrats are playing chess, and then they're cheating at chess. So the Republicans are getting beat on every level, legal and illegal. And it's not even a contest, quite frankly. I mean, we're up against
it. There's no question that there has been illegality.
I don't think there's any question at all that there is illegality, but the thing that I think people need to grasp is very quickly that, you know, you're talking about a democratic apparatus that is designed to ensure one party rule forever. And it starts with control over big tech and the media outlets and the shaping of people's perception. Forget about polling. They don't have to guess if their messages resonate, because via the wonders of Google, they know precisely who's clicking on what and what you like and what you do instantaneously. So in real time, they fine-tune their message. They, of course, bring into this all sorts of corruption and public benefits and give people motives for supporting the party apparatus. But now the real genius, in an evil genius kind of way, is that given mail-in voting and drop boxes and so forth, you know, the days of driving around picking people up in school buses and taking them to the polls are gone. They don't take anybody to the polls. They don't want you to go to the polls. They take your vote to the polls, legally and illegally. And they have produced a machine, again, on legal and illegal levels, that produces unprecedented levels of guaranteed Democratic votes. And the Republican Party largely just sits there and stares at this and continues to do business the old-fashioned way.
And a colleague of ours had come up with a wonderful turn of phrase, which seems to me to capture what you've just described, Sam, that Republicans have been focused, checkers you call it, focused on turnout.
Yes.
Getting those voters to the polls, especially on Election Day. And the Democrats have been focused on turn in, namely turning in ballots, any number of them, legal, illegal.
Perfect summation, yes.
Accurate, reflecting legal voters or not.
That's right. All across Pennsylvania on Election Day, you know, my involvement with the Pennsylvania Patriot Coalition, people are calling from the polls saying there are lots of Republican voters here and they're angry and fired up and this is great. Well, that's true. But three times as many Democrats have already voted, again, legally and illegally, via drop boxes and mail-in votes, and they're not even, they don't care if they go to the polls. In fact, they'd prefer they not go to the polls because that leaves it up to them to decide whether to show up. That's not what they want. They want to take your vote, again, in some cases, by literally buying your ballot, but they will guarantee you vote and it is delivered. John Fetterman's famous disastrous debate competition with performance with Mehmet Oz in the U.S. Senate race in Pennsylvania. Three quarters of Fetterman's vote was banked by mail-in votes before he stepped on stage. That's before we get to how many of his voters would have ever seen his disastrous performance anyway. But the point was most of
his voters... Or been affected by it, for that matter, I guess.
If they watched MSNBC, they would have been told, as it, literally, that he won the debate. But in any event, it doesn't matter because that vote was already in the bank. And that's not accident. The Democrats knew that when they picked the date that they would agree to step on stage. They knew precisely that they would already have, in effect, won the election before he stood on that.
Right. And the machine that they've built to both garner those ballots, legal and illegal, and process them and translate them into a winning majority is something that Republicans, as you say, may be now beginning to look upon with fresh and even admiring eyes, but they certainly weren't in the game this election or arguably the previous one in this respect. No. Sam, so let me pivot from all of that, important as it is. And again, thank you for what you and the Patriot Coalition tried to do in Pennsylvania to have it be a free and fair election. To turn to a gathering storm that we now see very much in evidence in Europe at the moment. At Substack, you've written about this earlier this week, I think, in which you talked about it's heading over a cliff. And that's a cliff that we may be rapidly approaching as well. Walk us through what's going on as you see it and its implications for this country as well as Europe.
Well, what we have both here and in Europe really are, first of all, these mad new Green Deal policies where, because supposedly we're all getting ready to die from climate change, we have to inflict all the, basically wage jihad against the fossil fuel industry. Then, of course, we've turned loose inflation by our own crazy spending policies, which affects us and the entire world. In Europe, in Europe, they're facing disaster. They're sliding into winter. People are in the streets. They're protesting. They're on strike. Literally, they're talking in Germany. They are literally planning for how to handle banking when the power grid goes down, stays down. In other words, how do you continue to bank and move cash in an economy when we're now back in the 1600s and we no longer have electricity, no computers, no ATMs? That's literally formal government. A formal government activity right now is planning for that eventuality in the short term. That's how bad this is. They are literally getting ready to slide over the cliff here. In this country, we have this giant propaganda machine that works for the Democratic Party, most of the major news outlets, pretending like, first of all, basically not talking about what's happening in Europe, and certainly not talking about the fact that we're only a couple of steps behind. And they're already rationing fuel oil in New England and New York State. The price of it anyway is going to make it unaffordable. Small town fire departments all over the country are bracing for a rash of kerosene fires, because people who don't have power are going to be forced to bring kerosene heaters into their home, and they know what that means. I mean, this is getting real, really, really, really fast. And, you know, people have talked about the diesel shortage and how we're about to run out of that, which means trucks are not going to move. Nothing's going to move. So it's, you know, what we were talking about AM Magazine is you can pretend like this is not happening and impact the perception of it. It won't stop it from happening, right? It's still going to happen. It's going to happen sometime in the very near future.
And Sam, just To add to that grim picture, there is, in addition, in Europe certainly, and seemingly coming here as well, the distinct prospect of a food shortage.
Absolutely.
As well as
absolutely
heating and power and the rest of it. All of these things, you know, needless to say, exacerbate the others, but it seems unimaginable, and it is even more unimaginable that we're not being told the truth of what is afoot, let alone why it's afoot.
Exactly.
That this country, with its enormous wealth and energy resources and power, is about to be reduced, as you say, perhaps to a 16th century economy and society. And that will be a very ugly place to be, needless to say. Sam Faddis, thank you for your leadership on all of these fronts, for your clarity in warning about them, and for your joining us with regularity for that purpose. God bless you, my friend. We'll look forward to our next visit with you next week. Next up, we will speak with a man who is working on the problem of our armed forces. It's a compelling story. Stay tuned for it right after this.
And throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
We're back. I'm very pleased to say we're joined by Nick Gray. He is the CEO of a remarkable organization. It's called US JAG, which stands for Uniformed Service Justice and Advocacy. And it does a unique mission at this moment on behalf of men and women in our armed forces who have been injured and who, sadly, seem to be, well, getting screwed by the military as a result, in order to deprive them of benefits to which they are entitled. This is outrageous, obviously, and Nick has experienced both in uniform as a two-tour non-commissioned officer in the United States Army and as a beneficiary of the services, actually, of US JAG, and he therefore knows wherever he speaks about its importance. And I'm very pleased to give him a chance to talk a little bit about this group and what it's doing and why it's so needed. So Nick, welcome to Securing America. Glad to have
appreciate
you with
it,
us.
Appreciate it, sir. Thank you for having me here.
Well, thank you for what you're doing. Tell us a little bit more about what's going on here and the magnitude of this problem.
Yeah, so US JAG, I mean, our sole mission here is to ensure that injured service members are medically retired. Simply put. And how we do that is by ensuring that both policy and procedure are followed by the Department of Defense in the discharge process of these injured service members. So effectively what we do is we conduct forensic investigations prior to a discharge from happening. And look for inconsistencies, discrepancies, things of that nature, to make sure that the command structure has in fact followed policy and procedure. Unfortunately, in many cases, that's not happening. So what happens is that these individuals who should be medically retired are then less than honorably discharged from the military. And what that does, it strips them of their benefits, their honor, and their dignity. It not only affects them, but also affects their family as well. And ultimately, it becomes the problem of communities across the United States.
So this problem, which would be, I think, outrageous under any circumstance, is being compounded, as I understand it, because some of these individuals, for very legitimate medical reasons, are seeking to be spared these COVID vaccines, which are being mandated, of course, on the military more broadly. And talk a little bit about how that is being used as another vehicle for, well, essentially stiffing them on the kind of benefits that they're entitled to, given what happened to them in service.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you use that, the vernacular, as far as it's being another vehicle, because the abuse of discharge practices have been going on, you know, for decades. The COVID vaccine is just another vehicle, as you mentioned, to carry out these abuse of discharge practices. And so one particular case that we are currently working, and I will refrain from saying the military installation or the service member himself, is that he was on his way to a medical retirement, had a stellar career, and he was injured. Multiple tours overseas, he's at the point as to where he can't even hold an M4 rifle. So he is no longer of any use to the military. That sounds terrible, but it's the reality. And what happened is that he had surgeries slated to take place as part of his discharge process. And the chief vascular surgeon issued him a medical exemption due to the fear of blood clots. He had a high propensity for blood clots. And one of the side effects of the vaccine is blood clots. And he had the first surgery and it was successful, but he had four more pending. And the issue is the fact that they refused to grant him additional medical exemptions for the COVID-19 vaccine and gave him a choice of either taking the vaccine and risk death or to be less than honorably discharged out of the military.
And this is despite their own medical professional saying that he should not be subjected to
vaccinations. Two doctors.
Wow. So again, talk this through as to what the practical effects are. And I understand you can't name the individual because his case is still going through the process, but what would the practical effect be? If he chooses not to risk death, having risked death for his country previously, of course, and suffered for it, but having the choice of not risking death in this manner that's not advised by his medical advisors, what happens to him under this, manipulated discharge practice?
Yeah. So what happens to him is the fact that he will lose his medical retirement. That's the first thing. The second thing is that since he is going to be classified as a less than honorable discharge, he is going to lose his rights for benefits from the Veterans Administration as well. All right.
So the less than honorable discharge is the thing that particularly sticks in my craw here, because I don't understand what is less than honorable about what he's done for his country, let alone the choice that's now before him.
There's nothing that's less than honorable as to what he's done. Less than honorable, commission of a serious offense, that's typically grouped into rape and murder and things of that nature. The simple fact of the matter is that he did nothing wrong. The only individuals that did anything wrong in this situation, the only individuals that were dishonorable was his command. And the reason why is because they themselves violated the laws of the National Defense Authorization Act. And so it goes to policy and procedure. That's the biggest thing here, is that the DOD is not following policy and procedure. So in this particular case, number one, medical precedence was already set in his situation from the first medical exemption. Number two, and this dates back to the 2012-2013 NDAA, is that if somebody is less than 180 days from leaving the service, they're not subject to vaccine mandates. So this is not just about COVID, this is about vaccines in general. So they violated that policy as well. So we intervened and we conducted our forensic investigation, wrote up a stellar report, and we submitted it. And the good thing is that they reversed course and they are now allowing him to be medically retired.
So in the event that, let's just say, playing that out, that hadn't happened, you hadn't intervened, you had not brought this relief, he would have lost his medical retirement and his other veterans' benefits. Would this likely have meant that if he needed procedures for additional surgeries, he would either have to forego them or presumably be impoverished in order to try to get the medical care that he was entitled to, given his service to our country, but was being manipulated in such a way? And is this basically driven by some sort of effort to cut costs for the military? Is that the rationale that is actually operating?
So primarily, you're exactly correct. So the primary reason as to why this is happening, and it's once again not just isolated to this particular case, but you know, hundreds of thousands of cases that are out there, because this is not isolated, but it does go to money. That's the primary reason, and it's money and it's promotion. So commanders' promotions are based off of force readiness. Force readiness is based off of deployable status. So they need to have the troops at 95% deployable status. When you have these injured service members that are in the medical board proceedings, they are non-deployable, yet they're eating up scarce resources that could be allocated towards healthy soldiers. So the medical board proceedings can take a year or longer, and that's eating up resources. So what they do is that they find any way possible to find minor infractions to move them out of the medical retirement process into a chapter process. That chapter process can take a matter of 2 weeks.
And the chapter process is what leads to these dishonorable discharges less than honorable, not dishonorable, I guess, but I'm not quite sure what the distinction is. It's bad, obviously, for the service member separating that they are other than honorable, fully honorable, especially when they've, as you say, done nothing wrong. They've conducted themselves in a thoroughly honorable fashion and suffered in the process, grave injury in many cases. Speaking of many cases, give us a sense of the magnitude of this, manipulation of the discharge process.
Yeah. So as I mentioned earlier, is that this is, number one, this is not an isolated case. Number two, this is common practice. And there are hundreds of thousands of service members that have gone through the same situation as this individual has, different circumstances, but the same outcome, minus obviously the fact that we won this case. In the Army alone, between 2004 to 2011, there were 420,000 discharges in general. 162,000 of those, or roughly 38%, were under less than honorable conditions. All right. So that's not to say that all 38% were wrongfully discharged, but a vast majority of them were.
And you estimate about 3 out of 4 are
correct,
in this category of manipulated discharges. Yeah. Well, listen, this is a fantastically troubling problem, and I had no idea. I try to follow this stuff fairly carefully. And Nick Gray, I want to thank you for what you and Uniformed Services Justice and Advocacy is doing to both address the problem with these men and women who have served their country with honor and to bring their plight to the attention of the rest of us. How do people find out more about your organization and how they can help?
Yeah, so anybody here can go to usjag.org and you can learn about our organization. As I mentioned, we've been around for 15 years. We're
have to leave it at that. We appreciate what you do and hope you come back to us with updates. Godspeed, my friend. Be right back with more right after this. Thanks for tuning in to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney. If you find the content of this program to be informative and valuable, I'd like to ask you to consider playing a part in supporting the organization that makes Securing America possible, our Center for Security Policy. We call the center the home of the special forces in the War of Ideas. We feature such warriors daily on Securing America as they diagnose the dangers facing our nation, develop strategies for thwarting them, and work with other veteran national security practitioners, legislators, and the American people to execute those strategies. Thanks to our friends at the American Family Network, we're able to expand greatly awareness of the Center for Security Policy's efforts and their impact. Like the real special forces, our effectiveness depends on having the ammunition, in our case money, to perform our mission. Please consider making a tax-deductible contribution at securefreedom.org. Thanks. Welcome back, and I'm going to issue a very personal as well as a very special welcome to our next guest. She is a dear friend as well as a very valued colleague in the battle space of the war of ideas, as well as the old-fashioned kind of war through her very important relationship with a very important individual in our defense industrial sector for many many years. I had the privilege of knowing and admiring greatly her husband, now the late Dr. Jack London. This book, a memoir really of his life and service to our country, both in the uniform of the United States Navy and as the executive chairman, well, he rose to the ranks through many, many years of service with CACI International to become its executive chairman. And this book, which our guest Jennifer London, his widow, has helped complete, is a testimony to service, love of country, and the call of duty that I think is so inspiring and so moving that I wanted to have Jennifer with us to talk a little bit about her husband, about his accomplishments, his legacy, and the enduring nature of his contributions through the kinds of commitments that he engaged in over the years, both with CACI in the defense sector, the U.S. Naval Academy, of which he was a graduate, and in so many other ways. Jennifer London, it's great to have you with us. Congratulations on the publication of Ever Vigilant, Leadership and Legacy by the Executive Chairman of CACI, Jack London. It's good to have you with us, ma'am.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here to join you and your listeners and audience. I wanted to mention that, Jack's book is a memoir. It is Ever Vigilant, Leadership and Legacy by the Executive Chairman of CACI by J. Philip London. It's available on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and all proceeds are going to military organizations, which we have always done with his previous books, which you might be aware of, Character, The Ultimate Success Factor, and some of the other books he wrote. My contribution to the book was primarily editing. It's really Jack's story. If you read it, you'll see it's like him talking to you. It's his style. And so he completed the book as a memoir and a way to let audiences know about how he built CACI. CACI is a government contracting company. It is a Fortune 500 company. Jack worked with the company for 50 years. He did 12 years active duty, 12 years of reserve. And as he entered the reserve, service, he took a job at CACI. CACI was started by two entrepreneurs, Harry Markowitz and Herb Carr, who came out of the RAND Corporation. And they were involved in developing a program called SimScript. But there was no one offering services for problem solving, troubleshooting. And so they created a consulting business. Harry left after 5 years. The company started in 1962. Harry left in 1967. Herb ultimately decided he did not want to be involved in the day-to-day operations. He brought Jack in 1972 and said, Jack, you take care of it. I don't want to have a boss, but I don't want to be the boss. So for 50 years, Jack continued to grow the company. If you can imagine, it's like Harry and Herb, you know, they dug the foundation.
Put the cornerstone in, at the very least.
Yes. Yeah. And then Jack came and built this huge, $5.6 billion company. And so this is his story of how he did that. But he also talks about how the Naval Academy and the Navy were critical points in his life. They were very important to him. And they laid the foundation that he used in his leadership. Honor, courage, commitment, dependability, loyalty. And so he carried those with him throughout his life. So I think the book appeals to audience who are thinking about military, in the military, veterans, but also people building companies. My contribution was at the end of each of the chapters, he talks about attributes that he felt really supported him and that he feels other entrepreneurs or those who are building a company would benefit from, like determination, perseverance, vision, and so on.
And of course, people who are familiar with CACI will remember that it had a bad patch for a time.
Yes.
And its reputation was terribly savaged by the press and critics of other kinds. And one of the most impressive things about Jack, and he was a most impressive man, was his dogged determination to clear the name of his company, to make it clear that there had been no wrongdoing. And he did. And he established, as you say, the further trajectory for its growth, its success, and its leadership. You know, we talk a lot on this program, and I think increasingly in the country as a whole, Jennifer London, about the dire straits in which our military now finds itself. And that's true of the defense industrial base as well, I'm afraid. But CACI has really stood out as an exemplary organization, despite that trouble, thanks in no small measure to Jack's vision and his leadership and his, as you say, his courage and his sense of duty. And so I think this account of what he went through, what the company went through, what the country has gone through, is both inspiring and a great read, very instructive for the kinds of people that you're talking about. Now, let me just say, you're a pretty impressive individual in your own right. You have a PhD in psychology. You've been a consultant both with CACI as a strategic advisor, but also with Fortune 100 companies around the country. And I think it's so important that, your efforts helped bring this thing to the full fruition that Jack had in mind. And I want to thank you for that, as well as obviously the very important contribution that Jack made to it. We have to take a short break. Jennifer London, we'll be right back with more on the book Ever Vigilant and the story that it tells and the continuing legacy of Jack London right after this. We're back, and we're joined by a wonderful friend and most, I think, impressive individual in her own right, and the spouse of an also very impressive individual, now deceased, Jack London, the former chairman of CACI International. We're talking about his book, which Jennifer helped put the final touches on, entitled Ever Vigilant. It's a memoir, really, of J. Philip London, better known to his friends as Jack, as an account of his experiences in the Navy and also in the leadership of one of our country's most important defense consulting and contracting firms. Jennifer, one of the things that I just wanted to give you a chance to talk a little bit about, because Jack was ultimately a captain in the Navy. He, as I recall, flew helicopters, if I'm not mistaken. He was very, very much, I think, formed by his experience at the Naval Academy and continued to his dying days to be very, very closely associated with that outfit. Talk a little bit about the legacy of Jack London as you see it, and as you're really carrying it forward through your own involvement in some of the organizations and efforts that he was so proud to be associated with during his time.
Well, he was an aviator, and he did experience some of very important events in our country. He was in the Cuban Missile Crisis blockade. He was also on appointed on the recovery team for John Glenn's orbital trip around the Earth. And he says in his book that having been part of those historical events and also having traveled around the world, we traveled around the world a number of times, it resulted him in appreciating what a treasure America is. And he was very patriotic. He took the oath that he made when he entered the military, carried that the rest of his life, and talked about
it. It has no term limit on it. It turns out that commitment to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. He lived it every day of his life.
And he said his veteran friends felt the same way. And I think that's admirable. And going back to what you said about the military earlier, there are some challenges with recruitment. I think we don't emphasize enough our national identity and our patriotism, but that was very important to him. He was a kid growing up in Oklahoma that ultimately chose to go to the Naval Academy, and I think his story is inspirational in the sense that that his life was impacted by his experience in the military. And when you talk about that bad patch that the company went through, he really stood pretty much on his own and made a decision. There was a report that came out, and a preliminary report that suggested that someone in his company was culpable for some egregious acts. And he, I just admired him so much when he said, everybody was saying, if he fired the person, the problem would go away. He said, I will not do that. What would my employees think if I were to, you know, fire someone based on an accusation? We believe in the rule of law. Innocent until proven guilty. And if our company is culpable, then we will take that take on the responsibility. However, you know, we need to make sure that the investigations proceed as necessary. And the company underwent 9 investigations and came out, you know, pretty much squeaky clean. And the reason is because he had instituted many years earlier a program of ethics and integrity. And that ultimately led to the writing of his book, Character, the Ultimate Success Factor, because he actually started it as a paper for his employees. And eventually it became a book. But the culture of the company, and that was a differentiator for CACI with their customers. If you know that the company is built on character and in ethics and integrity, then the customers will trust you. And that's the person that Jack was as well.
Yeah. And when you talk about, you know, the value of a book like Eternal Vigilance for those thinking about how they might start or operate their own business, there's just no better standard than that of character and integrity and faithfulness. And again, I feel it was such a blessing in my life. Jack actually served on the board of directors of our Center for Security Policy, as you know, Jennifer, for a number of years, and was incalculably helpful to us. Also, I'd like to just call attention to something that he ran, of which I was proud to be a participant over many years, a really seminal forum for talking about asymmetric warfare, something that too few, I think, in uniform and out for that matter, give much thought to, but that is so important to the kinds of challenges that we face at the moment, especially with respect to the Chinese Communist Party. It's all about asymmetrical, unrestricted warfare at that, as you know so well. And I just want to say, I think what I saw him do with the company and in his outside ventures with the Naval Academy and I think the Navy Memorial and so many other worthy causes that supported our military men and women, not just in the Navy, but I think writ large, was truly inspirational. So impactful. Go ahead.
He took on the role of thought leader in 2007 after 23 years of being CEO, being in the trenches and working to build a company, primarily through a strategic acquisition program whereby they acquired 80 companies. He took on the role of thought leader. And he started in 2008 and 2009 his Asymmetric Threat Symposium. And he wrote a number of papers to prestigious journals about the electromagnetic spectrum. He was actually talking about it and commenting on, you know, our invulnerability and the importance of EMS before this, you know, the Intel community really focused seriously on it in 2016.
And I'm afraid they're still not as focused on it as they should be. Alas, we need his leadership in this respect. Jennifer, we're out of time for today, but I'd love to have you come back and talk more about both the man and the legacy and what you're doing to carry it forward. But thank you for your time today. And thanks, too, for this terrific book. I'm very proud to have it in my own library, Eternal Vigilance. Check it out, folks, and come back to us for more Securing America next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.